I want to thank everyone for joining us tonight to Moms Fighting Autism. We have a wonderful webinar for you tonight. I first want to introduce myself. I'm your moderator, Nancy Bernotitis. I have a 13-year-old son with autism, and I've been very active in the autism community since he was diagnosed at the age of 4. I've served as president of the Autism Society of America Dayton chapter. I've worked as the assistive technology specialist for Goodwill Easter Seals, and I'm a regular contributor to Autism Today. There's two ways to participate in tonight's webinar. As you know, you can log into momsfightingautism.com, and the webinar is completely free. Once you register, you'll see a blue box in the upper left-hand corner of the screen. There you can click Listen In and hear the discussion via the Internet. You can click Ask a Question if you'd like to submit a question. And then later when it's time for our slides, you'll click Slides and you'll be able to see our slideshow. You'll want to sync the slides to whatever method you're listening, whether you're listening through the Internet or listening via phone. Be sure and click the button that syncs the slides with the sound or you're going to get an echo. Let's see. You can also listen in by telephone by calling 949-333-4806 and enter conference ID 168978#. All callers are immediately muted, so don't worry about background noises. We cannot hear you. Later in our webinar, I'll let you know how you can raise your hand and ask a question if you'd wish. Tonight's webinar is entitled Autism, what is it? Making Autism Fitness, Making Physical Activity Fun for Anybody, with Eric Chesson. Eric is an exercise physiologist and the founder of Autism Fitness. In addition to working with his young athletes on the autism spectrum, Eric consults with educational and therapeutic programs around the world. He presents workshops and his own Autism Fitness Initiative seminars for parents, educators, and professionals seeking to optimize the health and development of individuals with special needs. He lives in New York, and I'll let you tell people later how to contact you, Eric. Welcome.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I appreciate that, and I am excited to be on this webinar because I get to talk about all things fitness as they relate to the autism population, which is basically what I do, so it's a good fit. And shall we get started right away here?
Yeah, go ahead.
All right, great. So I will take it away from there. So this webinar is titled Fitness and the Young ASD Population. And in addition to the autism population, obviously, that's what we're focusing on here. But the concepts and the methodologies that I use are applicable to any age, any ability level, any skill set. And the reason that it can do that is I'm using general concepts, and we're going to go into those, that really cover the entire human spectrum. And when we look at autism, particularly with behavioral and cognitive issues, I like to tell people, particularly parents, that we're still looking at human behavior. It's just that in many situations, it's slightly odd or different or a little more acute. So whereas I would say, I think this is the worst movie I've ever seen, I'm leaving, an individual on the spectrum might have a third degree meltdown. So, but we're always looking at behavior. So what I like to start with is how I got involved with the autism population, because it's been a bit of a journey for me, and I didn't wake up one day and say, hey, fitness, autism, chocolate and peanut butter, let's put it together. It was more of my story, really, and how I got started with fitness in my teenage years, really. And I was an overweight kid, definitely became overweight around late elementary into middle school, and it had a huge detrimental effect on my self-esteem and my ability or willingness to socialize and interact with other peers and my self-image. as well. And then one day in high school, I just walked into the weight room having no idea what I was doing, but went in there and started moving the weight around. And then when I went into college, I started looking up more information on strength training and conditioning, and then learning from people who were excellent coaches and learning from people who were well-known in the industry, and then beginning to kind of formulate my goals and my philosophy. So fitness for me was something that became very, very personal and defined a lot of who I was and what my lifestyle was about, and still does to this day, which is why I have so much passion and enthusiasm about what I'm doing with my athletes on the autism spectrum. And I call them athletes because if you move on a regular basis and you're getting better and you're meeting new challenges, I consider you an athlete. And I'm not really a semantics guy. I don't like to go around changing definitions of words. But I think we need a much broader, much more generalized definition for athlete, because right now we just think of athletes as people who happen to participate in a couple of different sports. And I think we need a reconsideration of that. So going beyond my college years and into my formative years in education, and then career-wise, what happened was I was working as a personal trainer and going to graduate school for general psychology. And along the way, I had experienced some interaction with kids on the spectrum in summer camps and in other day programs. I had worked in camps for many years. And I always found kids on the spectrum fascinating. And this was before there was a lot of great information, such as Moms Fighting Autism, online or available. This was before the big, what I call the early intervention boom. So autism was not the more well-known issue or population that it is today. And in interacting with these kids on the spectrum, I just thought it was so interesting. And I had no idea at this point that I wanted to make it part of my career in any way, shape, or form. I thought I was going to do something in sports psychology. I wasn't really sure. And in my graduate studies, I had a colleague who worked in a program in New York City with teenagers on the autism spectrum. And she said, I know you have a pretty extensive fitness background, and I wouldn't necessarily call it extensive at that point, but I did have a fitness background. She said, would you be interested in bringing your program in to work with these teenagers on the spectrum? And I thought about it for a little while, and I said, all right, you know, I don't have any other real focus in my career right now. So I started working with these individuals, and around that time I was just starting to build a philosophy around my own training and what worked and what didn't in terms of fitness, in terms of exercises, in terms of exercise selection. And so I had these two learning processes going on at the same time. I was learning about autism and behavior analysis and best practices as far as teaching and behavior management and positive behavior supports. And then I had fitness on the other side, where I myself was continuing to grow and develop and increase my knowledge and increase my physical skill set, and then my ability to teach others as well. So there are two dynamics occurring at the same time. And when I was researching other methods or programs or other ways of bringing fitness into the autism population, or the best ways to go about developing and implementing a program, there really wasn't much out there. I think I found one article that said, well, fitness is good for special needs populations. Well, great, but that didn't really help a lot. So the conclusion that I came to and still hold today, about 10 years later, is that there is this great rift in the information between the fitness community and the autism and special needs community. And what I've made a conscious effort to become was a bridge between those two populations, because there is such a remarkable benefit that the fitness community can bring to the autism and special needs population. And there is so much, so many wonderful experiences and information and just opportunity that the autism population can bring to dedicated fitness professionals. And I will say, as somebody who represents the fitness industry, we have a real cockamamie industry. It's very strange. And just because people have a fitness certification or they're a certified personal trainer doesn't necessarily mean that they're good or should be within 10 yards of another human being in a fitness capacity. And I tell people now, since it's so difficult to figure out what certification is good and what certification is not good and what kind of education is good, I tell people, if you really want to know about a trainer, ask their clients. Ask their previous clients, ask their current clients, and find out if it's going to be a good fit. Because one of the beautiful things about fitness is there are so many different ways to get to the goal, to get successful, to get fit, healthy, active. But you need somebody that can accommodate your needs and accommodate what you want to do. And there have been many different aspects of fitness that I've tried and said, well, it's cool, but it's not what I want to do right now, either for myself or for my athletes. Now, around the time that I started Autism Fitness and had no idea what I was doing with it, I knew what my goals were. I wanted to bring fitness to the young autism population, but I didn't know how to contact other people or market myself or really get my stuff out there as I was beginning to hone this methodology and really figure out what I needed to know about the autism population and then what I needed to know about fitness. So what I did was I made a couple of cold calls to different people in education and people who ran schools and other enterprises dealing with autism. And a lot of what I got back, the feedback, was, well, what does fitness have to do with autism? And I think that was a cultural thing going on about 10 years ago, because we didn't have as much information about what fitness actually was. I think we still had some kids are athletic and they're jocks, and some other kids are more bookish and they're tech kids. But now I'm very grateful for the paradigm shift, because it seems that parents and educators and specialists realize that there needs to be a crossover, and fitness is a very, very crucial part of development for any individual. So if we're looking at academic abilities or we're looking at social skills, fitness can be an underlying catalyst for developing these different abilities, but it has to be done correctly. So how do we define fitness? Fitness is getting better at physical activities and having a general base of physical ability. So if we look at it that way, in order to meet the needs of daily life skills, we're picking stuff up, we're reaching, we're climbing upstairs, we're climbing downstairs, and then in an advanced setting, jumping and running and climbing on a playground, these are all basic skills that we need to develop, and many individuals on the spectrum do not have these basic skills. So if we go to slide one, and I'm just going to have Nancy interrupt me real quick. Did I go to slide one correctly?
Yeah, I can see autism and physical deficits.
Yes. Okay, that's where I want to be. So this thing is working pretty well. I'm very pleased with myself right now.
I am too.
Thank you. So if we look at autism and physical deficits, what is common to the autism population, and when I left the first graduate program because I couldn't stand it, I was in a program that was heavily research-based, had professors that really didn't seem to care all that much about their students. They were there for their research grants, which, hey, great, fine, but it's not my favorite learning environment. I need something a little bit more active, a little bit more caring, as do some other people. I think that's kind of popular. So I left that, but I eventually went into a graduate program for exercise physiology, hence my now being able to call myself an exercise physiologist. And when I was doing research into some of the literature and what's been discovered, or at least probed about the autism population and some of the gross motor or physical issues, I came up with a couple of interesting things. There were a bunch of studies that show there's a higher instance of gross motor deficits in children with autism as compared to neurotypical peers. So 12-year-olds with autism as opposed to or compared with 12-year-olds who are not on the spectrum. And when we're talking about gross motor, it's interesting what everybody considers gross motor or how different people look at it. If we look at the big movement patterns, walking, bending, pushing, pulling, a lot of individuals that certainly the majority of individuals on the spectrum with whom I've worked, and certainly the research shows that they have some definite physical issues. Now, the question is whether there is a neurological basis for the physical issues or it's a physiological basis. So is it something to do with the brain not sending the right signal to the muscles, or is it the muscles not being able to fire because of an inherent issue? I've decided that it really doesn't matter as long as we approach it with the right type of goals and the right type of programs. I would almost say it's a chicken or egg, but earlier, I believe last year, scientists finally put to rest that particular conundrum and decided that the chicken did in fact come first. So we're going to have to come up with a different analogy, a different cliched metaphor for that. Gross motor deficits include abnormal gait patterns. So how do we walk? How do we move? Does it look like our kids are struggling when they're moving? Does it look like they're not moving as fast, as efficiently? Do they have balance issues? Do they have coordination issues? Did they crawl, which is a huge issue also? Some of the athletes that I've worked with didn't crawl. Problem with that, crawling, if you look at it, very similar, very reminiscent of doing a push-up or one of my favorite activities that you can see on autismfitness.com, the bear walk. And the problem when children don't crawl is that they don't develop the core muscular. What we talk about the core, it's really the trunk, the hip flexors, the big muscle groups, the major muscle groups of the body. So when we don't develop those, we're going to engage in what we call compensatory movement, which means the body is still going to do what we tell it to do, but it's not going to do it as efficiently. And that's what kind of sets up later injury and back pain and those sorts of things that come along slowly, but when we hit, we know it. Now, I take a very preventative approach to life. I would rather have my 8-year-old athlete on the spectrum learn how to perform a squat correctly than fast forward 10 years later and have an 18-year-old individual who not only has autism but also has lower back pain, and if they are nonverbal or don't have an efficient communication system, can't tell me about it. So fitness has not only from a physical health perspective, but just from a general quality of life perspective, a fantastic preventative benefit to it, if nothing else. So one of the studies that I found on autism and gross motor deficits went so far as to say that gross motor deficits are so prevalent in the autism population that they could be part of the diagnosis. Problem being, the study said, nobody has ever come up with a succinct, unified definition of gross motor deficits. So that's why it's not really in there. But it's so prevalent in the population that it should be. One of the big issues that I talk about at every workshop or seminar, or in this case webinar, that I do is fitness versus sports. And this is such a cultural thing here in the U.S. When people confuse fitness and sports. And I will give the disclaimer that I am not demonizing sports at all. Sports are great. But the problem is that in the U.S. we value team sports, generally speaking, over any other type of physical activity. And the problem then becomes that we're valuing specific rules and movements and activities over general creative play. And it's kind of the same issue right now if we look at the education system, not to go on tangent, but one of the big arguments about the way that children are taught and young adults are taught right now is that it's all teach them how to take a test, teach them how to answer a test correctly. And it's similar with sports because children are being taught and at a very early age, and it seems earlier every year, to do the same repetitive things over and over rather than have a basis of foundational movement and be able to play with those. So rather than running and jumping and crawling and doing cartwheels and bending and pushing and pulling and all of these great movement patterns that can be put together all of these phenomenal ways, they're being taught, oh, you have to kick the ball this way, you have to hit the ball this way, you have to shoot a basket this way. And number one, it sets them up for failure most of the time because most kids aren't going to go on and play just one sport for the rest of their career, however long that is. And the second part, from a physical standpoint, and this has been demonstrated in the research, and a lot more of it is coming out and being published now, that the more specifically tracked a child is for one sport, the greater likelihood of injury because they're doing the same movements over and over and over, and you get repetitive stress on the joints and muscles. So I think I've gone a little far out from what we want to know about the autism population in terms of fitness. So let me bring it back a little bit. And I think the point that I just covered here with sports activities being finite, they don't carry over. They don't really generalize. So a soccer kick, is it difficult to do? Yeah, absolutely. Does it take balance and coordination? Yes, absolutely. But does it generalize to other skills? For example, is kicking a ball going to help a child be able to navigate a flight of stairs better or be able to balance in another situation better? What we're finding is that it really doesn't at all. But more general fitness activities do because they have a very foundational application, meaning if I teach Mary how to squat correctly, then she's going to be able to use her legs and her torso and her lower body far more efficiently in a variety of different activities. So if she goes to school then and does a yoga class there, she's going to be stronger and more adept. If she's walking up the stairs with a toy or a box of toys in her hands, she's going to be stronger and more adept. And it doesn't mean that we have to confine ourselves or our programs to just these particular activities. And that's why I provide these movement menus based on these big five movement patterns that I'll go into a little bit later. Sports are generally exclusive, meaning if you don't play baseball or soccer or football, or what I like about the X Games now is it brings a lot of individualized sports into the mainstream. But if you don't play these, I guess it would be anywhere from 6 to 10 really popular sports, then you're not an athlete. And I think there's a huge, huge problem with that. Not from a semantic standpoint of everybody gets a trophy, because I'm not a fan of that either, but the standpoint of, if you move regularly and if you're getting better at what you're doing, for example, my sister goes to the gym and trains very hard with weights every week, 3 or 4 times a week. And she refers to herself as a strength athlete. And I think that's fantastic because she's accumulating skills, she's getting better, she's healthier, and there's a goal in mind. Now, the goals may change, and maybe she's not going to get a trophy for it, but I think with fitness, the goals are a lot more beneficial and a lot more valuable than just looking forward to getting accolades for one performance or two performances. It's a lifetime. And the way that I structure my autism fitness programs is I want my athletes to have a lifetime of fitness, even when I'm not working with them anymore, which is why I want the information out there. I want other people to be able to take the information and really be able to use it and not just turn around and say, hey, it's really great what you're doing. It's more of building a community around autism fitness and around bringing fitness to every individual on the spectrum. So as I said before in my disclaimer, sports are not bad. They're just not the determining factor of fitness. And the way that I visualize this, because I'm a highly visual learner, not a good auditory learner, which is why I was never good with math either. And I hope that there are some callers on here listening in who can empathize with me. I did not do well with math as a kid at all, or as a teenager for that matter. The only time I did well with math was in college when I took an applied statistics class, and all of a sudden I got an A in math for the first time. Was that because I all of a sudden got smart, or was it because it was taught in a way that made sense for me? Now, I would love to think that all of a sudden my neurons in my brain kicked in and I got smart. The reality is it was taught in a way that was conducive to me succeeding, and interestingly enough, I began to like math in that capacity. When we do things that we are not good at and we continue to be not good at them, we're generally not that enthused about continuing to do them. So same thing with sports and fitness. If we keep saying, well, you have to play soccer or you have to play football, it's usually less reinforcing and less motivating than let's go out and play with this medicine ball. Let's see what we can come up with. And that's a high order of ability, too, is creative play. But we can get there, and I am going to show you how if you stay on this call. So there's my pitch for everybody who's already on but was thinking about where is this going exactly. So here's how I visualize this. Sports are not the top of the pyramid. They're a branch on a tree. They're fine. They're not bad, but they're not necessarily applicable or right for every individual. And this is not just kids. This is teens. These are adults as well. This is everyone. I played baseball in high school, decided I hated it. And then eventually I found martial arts, and I did two or three different kinds of martial arts. And then today, for years I was just doing strength training, and then one day I discovered Olympic lifting and decided that I wanted to start competing in that. So when you have this foundational basis of being able to bend and push and pull, you can jump to a new activity relatively quickly. And people ask me, well, what about riding a bicycle, or what about swimming? And I'll say, great, but that can't be the only thing that you do. Because if it's the only thing that you do, it's the same thing as saying, well, we need a good nutrition plan, so all you're going to eat is carrots. Carrots are great, but you can't just live on carrots. They're healthy, but you need to add other things. You need to have that foundational basis of fitness. So sports are not the top of the pyramid. It's not as though you are not an athlete and you can't achieve anything unless you're playing a sport. And I will also say that plenty of my colleagues in the fitness industry, some very high-level coaches and trainers, will happily tell you that athletes are some of the most injury-prone people on the planet just because they're doing the same thing over and over and over. Doesn't mean that they're not fit. Doesn't mean that they're not healthy. It just means that their bodies tend to break down a lot more than people who are doing a lot of general strength training and conditioning and play, really. The roots of the trunk of the tree are made up of general fitness, movement, and play skills, which you can read for yourself, which is why
my webinars are not made up of me reading right off of a screen, because that is not how we teach things in any situation.
So if we look at the roots and the trunk there of that tree, that's our general fitness. If our kids want to play a sport, fine. Having the general abilities there makes them that much more adept and that much better. If they are never going to play a sport, which I would say is the vast majority of kids, at least that I've met on the autism spectrum, fine. Because then they get a lifetime of fitness as well, and you can always create new activities. There's always a goal you can set. There's always play to be done, and we've really lost our sense of play, and that's something that with autism fitness I'm really trying to bring back. Where did I go? Did I go to fitness versus sports? Okay. My two major questions for any program, and this is kind of my official litmus test. So whenever I'm walking into an educational institution, whenever I'm walking into a fitness center, these are my two questions. And I will ask people, what do you say you do? What is this program about? What are you telling parents or kids or educators? What are your goals? And then what are you actually doing? And I take those two and I try to see if they match up. So if a program says, yeah, we're doing sports with the autism population, say, all right, very cool. From what you tell me, very cool. Let me actually see it. Now, unfortunately, the majority of programs that I've seen or consulted with, and these are primarily adaptive PE programs, they'll say, well, we're doing a baseball unit with our kids right now, or we're doing a kickball unit. And I will say, okay. And I will watch as there is a ball, or maybe two balls, or maybe even three balls on the floor, and the class, usually of 6 to 10 kids, kind of wandering around the entire time. And then every 5 or 6 or 8 minutes goes by, and one of the kids, it's his or her turn to get behind home plate and kick the ball, and then they stand there. And then the instructor yells, well, run to first base, and then they kind of walk to first base. And then the instructor writes home that, oh, we played kickball today, and Teresa got a single. Sounds great. That's not what actually happened. The problem is that there was just about 30 minutes to 45 minutes of that time that's devoted to kids being able to move, basically wasted. And it's not that people don't have good intentions. They have good intentions. The problem is that the technique and the programming is not there, which is why I continue to do what I do today. And really the fortunate thing about my experiences is that I was able to have the experiences in the fitness realm, and I was able to work with the autism population. I was able to put it together in some coherent fashion. So a lot of what I find is not that people don't care, it's that they don't have the resources and they don't have the information. And once they have the information, they're fine and they can program. Because I don't bring up a program and say, okay, you have to do a football unit, or okay, you have to do a croquet unit, or okay, you have to do a badminton unit. I'm getting to some obscure fitness activities. However, what I want these students doing is to actually be moving most of or that entire half hour to 45 minute period, because for the most part, I know they're not moving at home. I know that a lot of young individuals on the spectrum have relatively sedentary lives. They're sitting at school, they're sitting in front of the TV, they're sitting in their room, and then the rest of their waking time is spent being not too vigorously active. So if we only have this limited window of time, 30 minutes or 45 minutes, maybe twice a week, maybe three times a week. In some cases, I see it's 5 days a week, which is fantastic. We still want to use it appropriately, and we want to develop programs that are not cookie cutter. And I'll get into this later about objects and objectives. We don't want to build a program around
certain equipment or around, well, these are the sports we know, so that's what we're going to do. That would be the same thing as saying, as having a math teacher saying, well, I only know even numbers up to 22, so that's all we're going to teach. You have to have that entire repertoire of play and general fitness activities, and then you can do whatever you want with them. That's fine. I would never tell someone, well, don't put these activities in this order ever. It depends on the individuals, number one, because we want to develop a program that each individual is going to be able to have success in. We're going to build a program that satisfies the needs, not just the physical needs, and I'll get into that in a little bit. There are a lot of things that I'm previewing here. But the point is that we want individual-centered programs. So those two questions, what do you say you do versus what do you actually do? Now, with my programs, I only make two promises to people, that the athletes will begin to move better, and that's my job as an exercise physiologist and a fitness specialist, and eventually, maybe tomorrow, but most likely in the near or slightly distant future, they're going to enjoy movement. And that is key because that's where a lifetime of fitness comes in. It would be ridiculous to say that because someone did a set of 3 push-ups back in 1974 that they're set for life. But that's what we're doing if we're just tracking for sports or one particular sport, because I'm telling you, a kid is probably not going to stay with it. How many people do for the rest of their lives, and how many opportunities do they have to stick with that particular activity? And again, it's not about sports. It's about the fact that if we just plan for the sport, then we're missing all these other important things about socialization and self-esteem and, from the physical perspective, the general abilities. So what do we actually do? If we have to start with very, very simple activities, I would rather have an adaptive PE professional say, look, Ronald's tolerance of physical fitness and physical activities is really low right now. So what we're doing is focusing on standing on 2 spot markers for 3 seconds, making eye contact, and next week our goal is for him to hold a ball while standing on the spot markers. And for many kids on the spectrum, that is a more realistic goal. And I think the problem is that people bring their ego into working with any individual because they want their program to be the best, and they want to show how much they're doing and how quickly they're doing it. But what I want for my athletes, and I think the more laudable goal, is to increase not just their physical aptitude, but their motivation to engage in fitness activities. Reason being, I could have an individual on the spectrum. I can have an 8-year-old who moves very, very well. But if they have very problematic behaviors, or they're not going to focus on a task, then a lot of those abilities are going to fade away because they're not utilized. We're not continuing to develop them. They're not using them in a functional way. If we have an individual whose motor planning and whose movement ability is very poor, but they're very highly motivated, they want to do the activities, from a physical perspective, using the right exercises, we can get them there. And time, if we're looking over a lifetime, is really not that much of a factor because it's a lifetime that we have to develop this fitness. And for some of my athletes, it's taken 8 minutes to correct their squat or to get them to be able to lift something overhead and walk with it. Some of my athletes, it's going to take 8 years. And that's fine because they're progressing every week. Not necessarily every day, but every week, every month, they are progressing. And we're doing it at their level of ability. So rather than have this charted out program and try to do the round hole square peg thing, we're working with their abilities and building from there. And that, I think, is the only way not only to build a successful program from the the perspective of a parent or a professional or a practitioner, but it also provides a lot of respect towards that individual on the spectrum. I'm going to respect what their abilities are right now. I'm going to respect the fact that I think they can get better at whatever they're doing, and we can set goals for them. And I can keep my expectations for them high but realistic, because all of my athletes are going to be able to move very well, and all of your athletes are going to be able to move very well because the program is based around them. Let's go over play, because I love discussing this. And everybody's idea of physical play is a little bit different. With me, I like going out with my friends on the weekend, and we throw around medicine balls, and we come up with a bunch of zany ways to throw around heavy stuff. And if you ever turn on the ESPN World's Strongest Man competition, it looks a lot like that, except with much lighter weight, and not all of us have shaved heads. Those of you who have actually seen it get the joke there, and for everybody else, you know, tune in when they have it next time. But that's what drives us. That's what's fun for us. And then, you know, sometimes the jungle gym will be empty, so we'll get to swing across the monkey bars and do pull-ups and stuff like that. And we're not doing it just for – while we're doing it, we're not thinking, oh, isn't this healthy, and, you know, I'm strengthening my back and my shoulder. It's fun for us because we've been doing it for so long, and it's so reinforcing for us that this is our idea of fun. And we want to include as many people as possible in that. And if we look at play, what's interesting about play is that it seems like a very abstract concept. Like playing, what is it really? Now, play skills can be broken down like anything else. Now, me coming from a fitness perspective, when I think play, I'm thinking taking mastered physical fitness skills, so looking at bending and pushing and pulling and jumping and rotation and climbing and skipping and all this stuff. When an individual, I won't say a child because we should all be playing, and that does not mean video games either, because what happens with video games is the creativity is taken away because all the creative aspects are already there for you already. So all you do have to do is press the buttons. But with fitness, we have to create our own movements. We have to create, how are we going to get up this slide? How are we going to cross from one area to another? How are we going to lift this 20-pound rope together and carry it across the room? All these really cool things that I've done with individuals of every age and ability level. So with play, you take those skills that are already there, or those skills that are currently being taught, and you use them randomly, because that's what play is. It's a natural expression of things that we already know how to do. Now, the problem in the autism population, or not the problem, but I would say the obstacle, is that, number one, you have the physical deficits that I already spoke about in the beginning, and secondly, you have a population that doesn't often engage in creative play. It's more repetitive, a lot of stereotypy, or it's commonly referred to as stimming, and repeated behaviors that have a function, but it's not what I would call a very, very useful function. They have a purpose, but it's really not going to generalize to too many other skills. And so with play, if we, number one, teach the physical abilities, and number two, along the way, our athletes start to enjoy those activities as well, they will begin to develop play skills. And the emerging play skills that I see with my athletes, one of my favorites is my teenage athlete, Fidele, and you can see him on autismfitness.com if you go to the free videos there. He's the kid who's in every one of my videos. I've been working with him for years and years and years, and what he'll do when we're finished with a sequence of exercises, he may pick up the medicine ball and throw it to me, or he may pick up the rope and start swinging it. And if you have no idea what I'm talking about, just go to the rope exercises and you can see it. And what that tells me is he has, number one, mastered the activity to some level or some extent. And number two, he's motivated enough, he enjoys that activity enough that now he is able to do it. He wants to do it during his break. So rather than what he used to do, which he does still occasionally, you know, jump up and or run across the backyard while slapping his chest, which is still an occasional favorite of his, now he has options. And I think one of the biggest things that fitness does for us in life is it creates options. And not just from a physical perspective, but when we have greater self-esteem and when we have better self-awareness and we're able to socialize through fitness, there are so many new opportunities that arise. And people who know me and people who have heard my webinars or some of my lectures before have heard from me that I do not like buzzwords and I do not make unsubstantiated claims. And I would resist saying self-esteem and self-actualization and socialization simply because it sounds so good. It sounds like one of those too good to be true type of things. But I have seen it, and I have seen it in some of the most difficult situations and some of the most challenging individuals whom I've ever worked with, some who are adolescents with a diagnosis of autism and some other emotional issues as well, in the right environment. And good fitness programming is all about creating the right environment for that individual that sets them up for success while still challenging them. And eventually, they begin to enjoy the activities that they are doing, and they can do it in a group setting as well. And that is all part of what play can be. So I think what happened was, for a while, and this, it's all interesting, it all historically happened around the same time, where tests became standardized and physical education became more of a standardized curriculum, and everything that we do for the most part in a lot of our jobs is standardized. And so play went to the wayside. Well, play has no value. Play has a tremendous value because play is where we get creativity. Now, everybody who's on this call right now is on either a phone or a cell phone or a computer, and they are in their house, which I'm sure has many gadgets in there. All of those devices had to be developed creatively. And it's interesting, I just started my own strength equipment company because I've been working with a friend who's out in Iowa. And he makes this phenomenal strength equipment, really cool-looking stuff, no big machines or anything like that, all the kind of stuff that I like playing with and my friends like playing with. And I kept sending him drawings of stuff that I wanted him to make, and finally he said, let's just get together and put together a strength equipment company. And I said, fine. And that's just one of the ways that creativity can lead to new innovation. So all of the phones and the computers that you're on, those were originally a sketch in a notebook, and before that an idea in somebody's head. So we don't give creativity enough credit for the world that we live in now. And play is a creative process also. Play is a creative process for our bodies, but it also helps us to alleviate stress and lower our blood pressure and interact with others. So it's not as though as play is the opposite of work. I would say play is what makes work more productive. And if we want to look at this in a practical sense for the autism population, when you have kids who are elementary age or middle school age or high school age who are sitting all day and having to do task after task, whether it's academic or daily living, and they're not moving, that cramps down. It's like a vice cramping down on the brain. If they're allowed to move, which is why I'm a huge proponent of classroom fitness. In fact, I'm writing an ebook about that right now, how to bring fitness into the special needs classroom, because it's crucial not just to getting them physically healthy, but to optimal neurological or brain functioning also. And this is all stuff that's been proven already. Nothing that I'm putting out is junk science or speculative or something that was put out in the Journal of Quacks. But it's real information that we have that we need to start using, because the only value of this information is in how we apply it. So with play, what we want to do is develop skills, and we go from, I call it going from structure to chaos to structure to chaos, meaning that we need structure in order to teach. You can't just teach randomly, otherwise the skill never gets acquired. So I want to pick 3 or 4 different exercises that we're going to focus on. Are we going to do them a lot? Yes, absolutely. That's how we learn. So we may pick that squat and that bear walk and an overhead medicine ball throw and then a frog hop. And all of those, incidentally, include all of the big motor patterns, all of the big 5 movement patterns that I'll get into in a little bit. And so we take those, and that's our structured program. And then we see how our athletes, how our students, how our children generalize those to new situations, maybe on a small scale, maybe on a huge scale. It may turn their life completely around, and I've seen that happen as well. So, and then we're going to come back, and we'll say, let's move along on those skills now. And this is why fitness is a lifetime process. We can always get better at something. In fact, if we look at studies of people who are successful or people who are happy over a lifetime, they're always active in something, whether it's learning or fitness or socializing, and most importantly, doing all three in some capacity. You know, sitting in a chair doing Sudoku puzzles may be relatively stimulating to certain areas of the brain, but if you go out and, you know, do some pull-ups and do some bear walks and play around and throw a medicine ball across a field and chase after it and then come back, you're actually going to be, number one, better at the Sudoku puzzle, and number two, then you're able to balance out your life a little bit more. And it's all about creating the balance, and the balance that's right for each individual. I wouldn't tell every individual that just because I'm training for an Olympic lifting meet right now that everybody should do that also. But there are certain aspects of physical fitness that kind of cross over every ability level. My athletes are not going to squat as much as I do, and I'm not going to squat as much as a professional athlete or an elite level athlete does, but we're all on the same continuum. We all have human bodies. We can all move them. And incidentally, I've worked with several individuals on the spectrum who also have cerebral palsy and some other movement deficits, and it's the same thing. We start at the level of the individual, and we just move from there. So we're all on the same human continuum. It's just a question of where we're starting and what kind of program we're going to put together to get to the next place. And play skills can be assessed also. That's one of the things that I'm very adamant about, is taking data and recording. And even if you're not sketching it out on a pad, getting video, we're in the process right now with Autism Fitness with creating a video library that we want people to be able to submit video into, to show different individuals on the spectrum going through the movement assessment, and then over time showing what they've achieved and how they're moving differently and how they perform a sandbell throw now as opposed to 6 months ago when they first started. And to my knowledge, it's going to be the only video library of its kind based in movement for the autism population. It's something that I'm very, very excited about, and something that's probably going to take a good deal of time to really get going, but it's going to be one of those things that is going to be, I think, very, very valuable for parents and practitioners and other professionals. So what does a successful fitness program look like? Now, when I first started putting together fitness programs for the autism population, it was fortunate for me that I was primarily, and still do to this day with the individual clients that, or individual athletes that I have, I was doing all in-home activities because I never opened up an autism fitness facility. It didn't make sense from a variety of standpoints. So I couldn't be hauling around large machines, nor did I really have a reason to do so. So the basis of my program was increasing, from a physical perspective, increasing flexibility, strength, stability, strength endurance, being able to do multiple activities over a good period of time, so maybe over a minute or 2 minutes, and really look at mobility from the perspective of how well does this individual move? Can they throw a ball? Can they squat down without their feet coming up off the floor? Can they maintain tolerance of an extended period of exercise? So not by design, but by necessity, all of the implements that I was using were relatively inexpensive and could also be used in a variety of ways. And I had just stumbled onto one of the best training philosophies you can have, is using general equipment for all programming, because I can take a medicine ball, I can develop a program for an NFL player. I can take that same medicine ball and I can work with one of my 10-year-old athletes on the spectrum who has very little coordination, because it's more about the programming than it is about the equipment that we're using. But the equipment that we're using is there because it fills a specific need, or it fills a variety of different needs as well. So it can be as general or as specific as we need it to be. So here we have a couple of pictures, and this gets into my strategy and assessment, which I call the pack profile, and we put together the pack profile in the last year. It's something that I've always been using, but finally had to write down my philosophy and methodology in some succinct way, and a couple of really cool things came out of it. Number one, I finally figured out what I was doing, and number two, I was able to refine what I was doing into text and into an actual program. And three, I was able to create something out of it that is now available to anybody, which is the PAC profile assessment and programming template. So PAC stands for physical, adaptive, and cognitive. And these are the three most important variables or abilities that you're going to need in order to create a program that is appropriate for any individual or group on the spectrum. So physical, I think I've covered a little bit thus far. We know why physical is important with regard to a fitness program. The adaptive component is also the behavioral component. And with regard, we're not doing an entire assessment of behavioral issues or behavioral abilities. What I'm looking at is adaptive ability as it relates to fitness. So how motivated is the individual to perform different fitness activities? Are there any maladaptive behaviors, whether severe or not so intense, that we have to consider? Can they tolerate extended periods of activity? When I mentioned before standing on those two spot markers and attending for 3 seconds, that's actually the first exercise in the 20 activities that we have as part of the PAC profile assessment. And I've had people ask me, well, what happens if we can't get through all 20? I said, that's fine. Then you're starting at the adaptive component, which tells you a lot about your program. It means that your main goal in the beginning, and this is why it's a long-term process, your main goal in the beginning is not to try to get as many exercises and as many skills and as many activities crammed in as possible. Your first goal is to make fitness appealing or at least tolerable. And that means that if you have to start, and I'm still doing this to this day with some of my athletes because it's not about my skill set, it's about theirs. So if we have to start with 3 or 4 or 5 seconds of activity and then they get a break or they get to go do something that they wanted to do, that's fine. That's where we're starting from. Now, eventually, are we going to increase that time period? Of course we are. Eventually, are we going to increase their movement repertoire? Yes, of course we are. But for the time being, what they need, if we do that assessment, is they need to increase their tolerance of fitness activities. And incidentally, that's how it's going to eventually be reinforcing for them. Because we don't like doing things that we suck at or things that we don't like for extended periods of time. Nobody likes that. So to then say, well, that model or those rules of human behavior don't apply to this population is not only kind of disrespectful, but it's simply not true. So we want to keep that in mind. And if we have, you know, I can have an hour session with one of my athletes, and sometimes we'll get 6 things done. And I mean 6 things as in we'll get 6 medicine ball throws done. Fine. Great. Next time we'll get 7. And over time, when we layer on skills and when we make fitness more reinforcing and we find the activities that they like, they're going to do it more. And I'm a big advocate of doing, if we're creating a fitness program in the home, doing it for 5 minutes in the morning and then 15 minutes in the afternoon and then 20 minutes in the evening, because the time constraint argument, I never have time, could be true, but there is a way around that. The way around that is you don't have to do 45 minutes or an hour of extended fitness. But if you have 5 minutes here and 10 minutes there and 15 minutes here, then it can add up to an hour. And for young kids and for individuals on the spectrum, that can be as or more valuable, that exercise throughout the day or throughout the afternoon or even throughout the evening, than just doing an hour straight and getting frustrated and getting burnt out. So there's always a way to set goals and achieve them. It's just a question of programming for it correctly. So the adaptive component is actually what I consider the most important, because if my athlete is motivated, then it doesn't really matter what their physical ability is currently. We can meet that. From the perspective of me being a fitness guy, that's where my expertise is. That's what I love to do, is create the fitness program, create the activities, the exercises. Fine. That's the easy part, especially if they're motivated. Now, what about this cognitive component? Are we looking at just high and low? A little bit, but I want to know, my big question, because we're talking about this really in a fitness capacity, what type of learner are we dealing with? Are we dealing with more of an auditory learner, which I will guarantee will be a very, very small percentage of individuals, meaning you tell them to do something and they can follow directions? Are we going to have more of a visual learner? Highly likely, especially with higher functioning individuals. Are we going to have more of a kinesthetic learner, which means that when you guide them through the activity, you put your hands over their hands and raise up the ball or the sand bell or the weight overhead, then they get it? That's a good possibility too. And usually it's a combination of visual learning and kinesthetic learning. And that's been my experience with my athletes. They need to see it first, obviously, because if they never, it's not a cognitive deficit if you say do a jumping jack. They've never seen one, done one, or heard of one before, and they don't do it. That's just poor planning because they don't know what it is yet. So that's not a cognitive deficit. That's just something that we have to teach. The same way we would teach any other skill or identifying any other object. If they've never seen or written with a pen or a crayon before, we have to introduce it. So we're doing the same thing with exercise, which is why you'll wind up moving a lot also, because you'll be demonstrating these activities. And along the way, what I want and my vision and what the mission is with Autism Fitness is to get parents and professionals moving also, because it's very difficult to teach something that you don't like. But if there's some aspect of movement and physical fitness that you enjoy, not only are you going to be healthier, which is going to help you in every area of your life, but you're going to be able to teach it more efficiently. And if you think back to elementary school days or high school days, the teachers who were probably most effective and your favorites were probably the ones who liked the material the most. If you think about it, we learn best when we're having fun, and that gets back to play again as well. So the marvelous thing is that when we're all having a good time, that's when we perform our best with fitness and other areas of life, because then it doesn't feel like work. So we don't say, let's go outside and work on fitness, so let's go outside and play. Let's try this. Not, you have to do this now, or you have to do your exercises, because when you precede anything with the words have to, it's generally not all that sunshiny and rainbowy. It's usually the case that we say, oh, I have to. Okay, great. And it's the same thing for individuals on the spectrum. It's the way that we frame it and the language that we use, whether it's simple or very complex. And it's also what is their level of understanding from a cognitive perspective. How many tasks can they follow at once? If I say, pick up the rope, put it over your head, and then walk to me, and they can only follow a one-step direction, then it's going to be difficult for them in the beginning to be able to complete that particular activity. But if I break that activity down, and this is where the best practices strategies for teaching and for behavioral support come in. If I say, all right, I know that Christine can't do all three of those. I know that she can physically, but the three-step demand for her cognitively is going to be kind of difficult. What if I first taught her how to pick up the rope or to associate the term pick up the rope with the action of picking up the rope? Because we have to make sure that our athletes and students understand the connection between the words and the action. Because that's not a cognitive deficit. That's, I've never experienced this before, you have to show me. So we show them how to pick up the rope, and then I show Christine how to hold it overhead, and then we walk together with our arms overhead. So we've just completed those three activities. Now the question is, what is it going to take for her to be able to do that independently from a physical perspective and also to be able to follow the directions? So do we need to make, I'm a big fan of making the directions as short as possible. And that's what we call good coaching or good cueing. Because when we give too much information, and this happens with every single athlete, when we give too much information, if we're teaching jumping up, and we say, okay, bend your knees, get your feet flat on the ground, look forward, arms back, it's way too much information. But if I say, sit back and push against the floor as hard as you can. So I say, sit back, push up. That's a very simple cue. That's four words, and it's going to be far more effective than giving them an entire speech about how to perform a jump, because that giving them the entire speech takes focus away. Now, when we're dealing with a population, specifically the autism population, that usually has focus issues to begin with, the last thing that we want to do is start complicating things. When we complicate things, it makes it, number one, not as fun as it could be, and number two, it makes it frustrating. So to alleviate that frustration, what we can do is make the directions simpler and show the athlete what we expect from them, what the activity is, rather than allow them to make mistake after mistake after mistake, because that is never going to be effective. Number one, certainly from the self-esteem perspective, but number two, we want them, because we usually have limited time, we want them to be able to perform the activity as many times correctly as possible. How do we do that? We teach them how to do it correctly from the beginning, and we break the movement down. So if I know that Christine's not getting that whole movement to begin with, that picking up the rope, holding it overhead, and walking, I'm going to break it down. First, we're going to work on picking up the rope. So that entails bending and pushing, two of those big five movement patterns. I'm happy with that. Now, holding it over her head, it's already over her head, so now she just has to hold on to it longer. All that's going to do is increase her shoulder stability, so I'm perfectly happy with that. And then walking to me, well, that's a third objective. That's going to take some trunk stability, some shoulder stability, and also some strength endurance, so there's the physical aspect. And then from a cognitive aspect, if Christine starts to put those three movements together, she's building her cognitive aptitude, at least as it relates to fitness. Does it mean that she's going to go out and score better on a standardized test? Probably not, although she may. But probably not. Does it mean that we've just increased all of the neurons in her brain? For a short while, we can demonstrate that. Overall, maybe over a long term, certainly. But in this instance, has she been able to chain together three different ideas or three different concepts and do them in succession, 1, 2, 3? Yes, she has. Does that have generalization to daily life activities? So take the dish off the table, put it in the sink and wash it. There's a three, or actually a four-step activity if you're going to dry it too. These are the things that generalize, and these are the aspects of fitness that are often missed but are so important, because not only are they going to help develop the skills within that fitness realm, but they're going to generalize out to other abilities. And, you know, baseball swing is great, very hard to do, but it's not going to generalize to too much. But performing these types of activities, here we see some pictures on the screen. I have one of my athletes throwing a ball. I have one swinging ropes, one raising a sandbell over his head, another doing a bear crawl. So, and actually I think the one doing the bear crawl is the same one doing the sandbell overhead. So we have three athletes there, three very different athletes, extremely at different areas of the spectrum entirely. But they're all able to do these particular activities and all able to get better at them. And those activities are going to create strength and stability and coordination, no doubt whatsoever, in each one of these individuals. And we can make these programs as individualized and as specialized as we need them to be for each individual. So I can take that bear walk, and I can modify that so it's even simpler for an athlete that cannot yet perform that activity. And then from an adaptive perspective, I may have an athlete who loves the bear walk, who wants to do nothing but bear walks the entire time. So in that case, we're going to have a lot of experience with the bear walk in that session. We're going to throw it in a lot because we want the session to be reinforcing. For an individual who does not like the bear walk all that much, I was speaking with a parent the other day who said, oh, my daughter does not like the bear walk. She, you know, it's challenging, it's tough for her. And I said, all right, we'll use it as a transition activity. So when she's going from one activity that she likes to another activity that she likes, or at least likes a little bit more than the bear walk, she can bear walk from one activity to another. This way, it's almost an afterthought. It's almost something that we're throwing in. So rather than put a big spotlight, it's the same thing as putting a big spotlight on someone who has tremendous stage fright or apprehension about public speaking, and saying, all right, we got your big spotlight, we've got the microphone cranked up to as loud as it can be, go ahead. And that person is probably going to freeze, and they're going to get overwhelmed, and they're going to get anxious. But if you just say, hey, here's a microphone, go right ahead, they may still not be very comfortable, but at least a lot of that anxiety is alleviated. And what I've come to learn about a lot of my athletes on the spectrum is a lot of them, particularly the higher functioning individuals, and I mean higher functioning from a cognitive perspective, are very, very anxious. I've read a couple of articles and seen some research about the rates of depression and anxiety disorder in autism and how it's very underdiagnosed because it's difficult to diagnose in many cases. So the last thing that we want to do
is create more anxiety, especially around physical fitness, because this is supposed to be a fun leisure part of the day. And believe me, I know that for many individuals it is not to begin with, but that's the goal. And if we program accordingly, if we take into account their physical abilities, what can they do right now? So what are our baseline abilities and where do we want to get to? So I have in that PAC profile, I have 20 exercises, and I chose those because they have very specific, very general application in all areas of physical development and physical ability, but very specific application to those five big movement patterns. So we can tell a lot. And as I said before, the first one is just standing on two spot markers, because if we don't have tolerance of new activities, that's what we have to build first. It's not the worst thing on earth. It's just we have to figure out where we have to start. The adaptive component, how motivated? If I don't have a motivated athlete, that's going to be the one that's not standing on the spot markers for 3 seconds attending. They're going to be the one that's across the room. So we have to build up that tolerance to physical activity. If we don't have the tolerance, then it's going to be tough to develop the enjoyment, because we're not going to get enough time to go through those activities in the beginning. Then from the cognitive perspective, what's our teaching strategy? I never want to use too many cues, and I want to simplify my language, but it's also a question of what type of learner do we have? If I know that Max is a very visual learner, then every single new activity that I do, that I teach him, I'm going to demonstrate, and I'm going to demonstrate it over and over and over, and I'm not going to get frustrated. And it's a difficult thing to tell people not to get frustrated, because your natural reaction is going to be your natural reaction. So don't appear frustrated is what I implore everybody to do. So even if you are, even if you're showing the rope swing for the 55,000th time, or the 55,000th time, it's one of those things where you just have to be in a very zen way, in the moment. And right now what you're doing is you're teaching that rope swing. And when they get it, it's going to click. They're going to get it. If it's being taught correctly, if they're being reinforced correctly, if they're in that safe, very supportive environment, it's going to happen. It will, eventually. So the key is that you just have to keep on pace with that particular individual. So from the cognitive perspective, you may have an athlete who needs to be shown something 500 times before they get it. So that's what their needs are, or those are what their needs happen to be right now. So we have to honor that. That's the way that we develop goals, and then we meet those goals. That's the only way. Because if we start setting goals that are too high and are not able to be met, it's frustrating for everybody. But if we go slowly and we say, all right, we're doing 5 rope swings this week, and our next goal, and it doesn't have to be weekly, it can be the next session, it can be a couple sessions later or a couple days later. I think in sessions, because, of course, me being the practitioner, I set up sessions. But the next goal would be getting 6 swings or 10 swings, or instead of doing 15 seconds of swings, doing 20 seconds of swings, or 25 or 30, whatever makes sense for that athlete. Let's move on to slide number 9, because I've been on this one for a while. So here are my rules, and this is teaching exercise effectively. Rule number 1, you can't force fun, meaning that you can't tell somebody they're having a good time when they're not having a good time and expect it to automatically change over. So if one of my athletes is clearly not enjoying themselves, I can't say, oh, no, wait, you like this. This is great. We're having fun. I have to prove it. I have to set up the environment so that they are successful, so that they are having a good time, or at least not having a terrible time. If that means that in an hour period we get 2 things done, but they have access to music or to a break and something they enjoy, that's great. I draw the line at edibles. So doing a couple jumping jacks and then having some gummy worms or some tortilla chips is not exactly my idea of effective programming. So apart from edibles, and that also means soda or other sweetened beverages, I would kind of make my line there. But anything else, even if it's sitting down and playing 5 minutes of video games and then getting back up and moving, that's fine. You know, that's a highly individualized program. And it makes sense in a lot of cases to do it that way, because that's how we're slowly introducing fitness. Second point here is we want to break the movements down. What comes first? So if they're not able to do that bear walk, what part are we starting from? Are we just starting from getting them comfortable being in that position on the floor, so having hands and knees on the floor? Do we need to start with tolerating that position for 2 or 3 or 5 seconds? Okay, great, we'll start there. Can they do a bear walk, but they can only do it for 2 yards or 3 yards? Okay, then our next goal is to get them to do it for 4 yards or 5 yards. Are they already great at the bear walk and they can do it? Fantastic. It doesn't mean that we're not going to do it anymore. That's kind of silly. The whole point of teaching exercise to the point of mastery is so that we can use them in other situations. That's just the beginning. And I have people ask me, well, what happens when they master all the 20 exercises in the pack profile? And I say, that's just the beginning. Those are the foundational movements. That's what you need in order to be a healthy, physically active human being. After that, that's when programming gets really cool and really funky, and you can really get creative with that. But with those 20 different activities, you have to satisfy those first before you can move on to something else in that class. So if they can't press a 2-pound sandbell overhead yet, we're not going to move up to a 4-pound or a 6-pound yet. We're going to be able to press that 2-pound sandbell overhead in the beginning and progress from there. So where do we have to start? Where do we have to break the movement down? If we break down that bear walk or we assess that bear walk and, okay, Tim can go 5 feet in the bear walk, our next goal is going to be, all right, have him go 10 feet, or he's really good at it, have him bear walk in between activities. And that's where programming gets really cool, and that's where you get to take ownership of that program, or your athletes get to take ownership, and you say, hey, you can do these 10 different exercises. What order should we do them in? Or come up with an activity. That is where we get into creativity and play in fitness, because they already have these abilities. Now they can use them in many different ways. Steps should be appropriate and specific to the individual athlete. Groups are trickier, but it can be done with groups, and there are two different ways that I work with groups, and I'll get into that a little bit later. I believe the slide is in here. Do I have it? No, I don't have my groups slide in here, so I'm going to go over groups right now here. With groups, there are only two ways that I've found to be effective for groups, and they are obstacle courses and circuit stations. And they're very similar, except with obstacle courses, they're going through all the different activities. There may be 4 or 5 or 8 at once. You have one athlete go, and then when they get to the next station, the other athlete goes. Or you have circuit stations where they're staying at each station for a designated period of time, either 30 seconds or up to 2 minutes, usually not 3, either by themselves or often with a partner, doing a specific activity and moving on to the next one. Why do I do it this way? Because if you have individuals in a group that have different abilities in all three of those areas, in the physical, in the adaptive, and the cognitive, it's going to be very difficult to have, and this is why sports with a lot of classes, if you have a class of kids all on the autism spectrum, I can guarantee you're going to have some differences in their abilities. So if you say, all right, we're going to all play kickball, you're always going to have that one kid who already knows how to play kickball and is already good at it and is already bouncing around, and the rest of the kids who are not up to that level yet. And it creates for some difficulties, a lot of frustration, because the kid who's already adept at it wants to play, and the others want anything but to play. However, if I set up circuit stations,
And I have a medicine ball toss at one. I have rope swings at another. I have stepping over cones at a third. And I have a frog hop at the fourth. Every time we switch with those activities, so say after a minute we switch and I have a new athlete at that station, I can immediately regress or progress. And those are the two most important concepts about programming that you'll ever learn for fitness programs with this population. I want to be able to regress the activity and make it simpler, or progress the activity and make it more challenging. So if I have an individual who is not adept or not ready to perform those frog hops yet, I may just have them do a very simple double hop, or a very, so just with 2 feet hopping to another pair of foot markers. And then I have another athlete or student who's very adept at the frog hop, so I'm going to have them doing the frog hops and maybe adding something to it also. And each time I switch, after that minute or minute and a half, I can take that station and I can make the activity simpler, or I can make it more challenging depending on who's coming over. And you can't do that with any sport. It's just impossible with a team-based sport. And it's very, very easy to control and manipulate the environment this way when you have the obstacle course or you have the circuit stations. And then you can program for each individual. So if one student has the goal of just standing on the spot markers and bending knees, they can work on that at that station if the next student to come across can already bend their knees and then they're working on stepping over some hurdles, they can work on that at the station. So everybody is able to meet their goal within that group program. Does it help when you have some other practitioners in the room? Yeah, absolutely, with a group. I would always say that. So other than having additional reinforcements in the way of other instructors, those are the two most efficient ways and most successful ways, the only ways I've found to work with groups on the spectrum. Want to limit those verbal prompts. So rather than say, do a jumping jack, if you use all of these bend knees, jump up, especially if they're not familiar with the terms, also it's too much information. It's not going to get through. It's not going to get through with a neurotypical person, let alone an individual who has the complications of autism. We're better off demonstrating the movement, assigning the movement a term. So this is a jumping jack, rather than saying, get your arms up, get your feet out. And those are things we can do later. For example, I have one young man who's actually 23 right now, and we do jumping jacks in the gym, and sometimes his hands have a tendency to close. So while he's doing the jumping jacks, I'll just give him a cue, hands open, and I see all of his fingers. So that's something where I can cue it because he already has the movement down, but it's not something that I started doing from the beginning of teaching the activity, because a lot of the activities that we do in autism fitness and that I use in my programs they're simple, but they're complex. So if I said throw a medicine ball, there are so many components of that. It's pick up the medicine ball and then hold it to your chest and then push it away from your chest and make sure I'm looking. There's a lot going on, but we don't need to label everything that's going on. We need to label one or two things that are going on. Always, always, always want to use behavior-specific praise. Just saying great job is okay, but we want to be very specific about what they're doing a great job with. So if it's, in this example that I give here, great job bending your knees, as opposed to just saying, oh, yeah, you're awesome. Well, what am I awesome at? And if we take this back to a human perspective, when I used to write, I still do, but I used to write articles, and then I'd show them to my family. I'd show them to my mom. Mom, what do you think of this? Oh, it's great. What about it is great? Oh, the whole thing is just great. That tells me nothing. It tells nobody anything. And it's nice to know that you're good, but what about it worked so that I can do it again? So giving that very specific feedback is very helpful. Tell them exactly what they're doing. We don't have to go at length. Oh, I love the way you bent your knees and got your knees out. But be specific about the activity that they're doing. Great bear walk. I like the way you move fast. is perfect for a lot of athletes on the spectrum because it tells them exactly what they did correctly, and it increases the likelihood that they're going to do it correctly again. So great job is okay. It's nice. You mean well, but if you really want to get that A-plus performance and to make exercise reinforcing for the individual, because they will enjoy it when they know they're good at something. And I've said in the past, if there's no other point during the day when an individual on the spectrum, a student or a young adult, is told that they're good at something, I want it to be during fitness or during their PE class, because they're going to carry that with them. And I've seen it happen too many times to doubt it at this point. So the behavior-specific praise is very, very crucial. And being told exactly what they're good at as opposed to just something very general. So here we're moving from the general to the specific. We want very, very specific praise and feedback. And I never do that when my athlete is doing something incorrectly. I just go back and I show them again. So I'm never going to highlight what they're doing wrong. I don't say, no, not like that, or don't do it that way. That, again, that's too much unnecessary information, and it's not going to help either. I just want to reinforce what they should be doing and what they're doing correctly. And eventually they'll get it. In terms of reinforcement, how do I get this student or how do I get my child to enjoy this? What you want to start doing is pairing those fitness activities with other things that you already know are reinforcing. So if they're really into music, if they want to listen to their iPod, then we do a minute of exercise and then they can listen to their iPod for 2 minutes. And what we do eventually is it's called thinning the schedule, or we do more exercise and less music over time. In some cases where we have very low adaptive functioning, that individual is going to tolerate exercise not too well for a long period of time. So maybe we'll do 10 seconds or 20 seconds or 30 seconds, and then they'll have access to going along with this iPod again, to the iPod for 5 minutes, or they'll have a break for 5 minutes, and then they'll come back and do another 30 seconds of exercise. My goal with that is to then get 35 seconds of exercise, or 40 seconds, or a minute of exercise, and then maybe 4 minutes of the other reinforcer. Now, we're always using behavior-specific praise, because, again, we want eventually the exercise activities to be reinforcing, and they will be, but it might take time. So by using these secondary these known reinforcers, it's going to be very helpful, and especially if we find a preferred fitness activity that they like. So maybe they don't like the bear walk, as was the case with this young girl that I'm doing a program for now. She doesn't like the bear walk, but the medicine ball throws seem to be her thing. So do a couple medicine balls, do a quick bear walk, and then back to the medicine ball throws. And that's the way, if we look at anything in life, that's the way we learn to tolerate and eventually enjoy things that originally were not very fun for us to do, intermittently between things we actually like to do. So we sit down and we write out checks for our bills. Not too fun, but if we do it in between listening to songs that we like, it makes it a little bit more tolerable. But I will always say that doing fitness activities is going to be a lot more reinforcing than paying bills. So here's another concept that I was telling Nancy when we were first getting started, and if you were on the line, then you might have heard part of this conversation, that I've changed around a lot of these slides recently because I've come up with some new stuff. And one of my mentors in the fitness industry and in life in general, and I just spoke with him yesterday, a man by the name of Dave Jack, who works with Men's Health and Reebok, really, really fantastic fitness professional and a great human being. And I told him this story about one of my athletes. Happened to be Fidele, the teenager on the site, and I was doing a video. I was shooting some exercise videos with him, and at one point I had asked Fidele to do, I think, an overhead press or a mid-ball throw, and then he put the ball down and he ran across. You can. I don't even know where the video is right now. I must have it. But he ran across the driveway, and I turned to the camera and said, "Okay, we're doing that now." And Dave thought this was the funniest thing he had ever seen. And we referred to it as the "we're doing this now" concept. But what the concept is really about is being able to be cool under situations that could be frustrating or anxiety-provoking or just change very, very quickly. And if you've worked or if you live with the autism population or an individual on the spectrum, you know that things can change very quickly sometimes. So it's become kind of a mantra for being able to assess the situation very quickly and just act accordingly. And sometimes fitness is going to drop by the wayside because it's a safety issue or there's something else that needs to be addressed. So here, I don't know, I've only previewed these couple slides once before, so this is my idea of my interpretation visually of being cool and being able to just go with whatever's happening. So here, of course, we have Miles Davis, Tyler Durden from Fight Club, and then Jules and Winston from Pulp Fiction. And these were all characters or real-life musicians in one case who were perceived as being cool because they were calm under situations of stress. And I just thought that it was a good interplay between what I expect from myself and other practitioners when they're working with the population, with the autism population, just being able to make sure that the goals make sense and to know that there's time to achieve those goals. We have to deal with what's in front of us and what's going on. I have athletes who will have a tremendous day on Monday and then have a lot of difficulty on Wednesday. And that's just the way that life works on occasion. So we have to take that into account during our program. Doesn't mean that we're not going to get anything done, although some days it does, but it means that we have to coordinate our programming with the state of being of the athlete on that day. We still have goals, and we still want to get those goals. And it doesn't mean that we're going to trash the program entirely, but some days we have to modify. And that goes for any athlete. It's only fair to extend that courtesy to the autism population. So that's what we want to aim for, what we want to avoid. If you can't tell on the left there, that's Axl Rose having one of his classic tantrums. A scene from one of my favorite movies, The Big Lebowski, and a scene from just about everybody else's other favorite movie, the Harry Potter series. So just having that explosive reaction or just an angry reaction to not just problematic behavior, but when an individual performs an exercise incorrectly or they're just not getting it, it'll happen eventually. And this comes back to, and again, I will give the disclaimer that I am not demonizing sports, but we see a lot of interesting coaching strategies with sports where children as young as 7 or 8 are being yelled at for not paying enough attention to the game. And if you think about it realistically, that's not a good way to get them to enjoy it. And then it strikes me as very strange when parents and other individuals think it's surprising that kids don't want to play sports anymore because they're getting yelled at on the field. It doesn't really make it reinforcing. So we have to consider first the individual that we are working with and the fact that they may not find this the funnest thing on the face of the planet. And for me, not only as an exercise physiologist, but someone who leads a very active lifestyle, and when I'm not in the gym lifting weights, but I'm preparing to go to the gym tomorrow and lift weights and do everything accordingly. Although I do have maintain a social life outside of that, because we're still striving for balance. But the point is that for me, looking at exercise, I love it, and I'm working with kids and teens and adolescents and young adults every day who don't necessarily find it their favorite thing, quite the opposite. But I want to focus on what their needs are rather than what I would do in that situation. And that makes it a very individual-centered or client-centered or student-centered program. And that's what it really means. Again, I'm not a fan of buzzwords at all. But to kind of go with that theme, you have to consider what the individual needs first. So when we talk about individual-centered, we build a program around that particular person and their needs from a physical and adaptive and a cognitive perspective. And I'm sorry that I lost my train of thought there for a second. Let's get into the Big Five movements because I know I've mentioned them a little bit. And the reason I'm general about these, and I did not make these up, this is something that I learned from, and a couple of people in the industry, in the fitness industry, use it, but I got it from a guy by the name of JC Santana, who's put out a lot of really good informational products, and he runs a facility down in Boca Raton, Florida. However, he presents all over the place. And so these are the Big Five movement patterns. So this is what is the basis of all of my programs. It's we have pushing, which is movement away from the body. So a medicine ball throw would be pushing. Pushing the sand bell overhead would be pushing. We have pulling, anything towards the body. So if we're pulling a resistance band towards us, or if we're picking something off up off the floor, this can be a pulling motion, or climbing something is part of pulling. Rotation, movement around the body. Bending would be squatting or frog hops or bear walks. And then locomotion, getting from point A to point B. So we have walking, we have skipping, we have running, we have hopping, we have the bear walk is actually a way to locomote. And when we combine these different activities, it's not as though we just do one of each. We combine different activities to create more complex movement patterns. So in that pack profile for the programming, what we start to do is create movements that involve a variety of combinations. So we can combine pulling and rotation. We can combine bending and locomotion. We can combine pushing and then bending, or have an activity that has the two of them. So they're not all mutually exclusive. They're all things that we want to do in these movement activities. And some of them will start with single movements, meaning that we may just push something overhead, but eventually we may be doing a walking overhead push where I have an athlete push something, put a weighted object overhead and return it to their shoulder while they're walking also. And of course I know that describing fitness activities is much more difficult than showing it, which is why I have a lot of videos on autismfitness.com and on my blog, ericchesson.com. For people to see, because just describing it, and that's why I stopped describing exercises in my articles, because you need the visual. Again, people being more visual learners and kinesthetic learners, especially when it comes to fitness activities, you have to take that into account. So those are Big Five movement activities, and that's what all of my exercise programs are based on, and it just depends on the individual with whom we are working. So where can we perform all of these movements and put together these programs? I would argue anywhere. I would say the more different environments in which they are performed, the better, because one of the big deficits in autism is generalization and being able to take a skill and utilize it in a variety of situations and environments across different people as well. You have the classic example of a student who will say hello to one teacher in one classroom at one time of day, but won't expand upon that skill set and be able to say hi to other people in the school. And that's kind of an extreme example, but things along those lines do come up regularly. So we're looking at the home, the classroom, the park, the backyard, and what I really like to do is get as many people on board and involved as possible, and and really have fitness everywhere, because the more it's very difficult to do too much fitness activities, especially when we're doing the general movements, to have that play all day. I can tell you from experience that it's certainly not a bad thing. And the more people that are involved, the more generalization you have. So the athlete is not just doing medicine ball throws or animal-based movements with the fitness practitioner, but also with his or her parents in the classroom. They're getting more exposure to it in general. And that's a great thing, because then it's going to have a lot more practicality in their life, and they're going to have more opportunities to succeed. So taking it outside, being inside, and kind of changing up the environment is very helpful. And that's one thing that I like to see with my athletes, is if they're able to perform a given activity indoors, how do they do with it outdoors, where there's more noise, where there's more sunlight, where there are more distractions? Are they still able to do it? And that also gets into the adaptive component. Are they able to perform an activity in different situations where they don't have necessarily a static environment? And then are they willing to do it with other people? So it's not just the fitness professional providing fitness activities, but it's also a parent or it's also a teacher. And then it really becomes part of a lifestyle. And then in terms of fitness centers, as autism fitness continues to grow, one of our goals, especially coming in September, we're going to be doing an autism fitness certification program, which is going to be very comprehensive, and I just want the most dedicated people involved. The idea is to get people in fitness facilities to create that bridge, as I mentioned earlier in the call, between the fitness community and the autism community, and I want other people to be able to offer these types of programs. So fitness centers soon, I think, are going to be catering more towards the autism and special needs population, and that's one of my big goals for the near future, because I think these types of activities can and should be available everywhere. They're just not, because, again, we have that great rift between information, and there's great information out there. It just has to get to the right people. Why did I lose my slides here? I lost my slides and went back, connecting to the server, and we're back. Okay, if that was the only glitch here, then I'll take it. So let's go to my review of a lot of information, and I've been told before that it's never good to put more than 4 points on a slide, but I did, just to be a rebel. So what do we want to do here? We want to assess physical, adaptive, and cognitive ability levels. And I'm multitasking here because one of my cats desperately needs, even though he's not supposed to be in my office, desperately needs to have his head petted right now. So I'm going to try to read these and pet Mr. Kennedy at the same time. And we want to teach prerequisite skills prior to more complex activities. And this is where I see most kids getting turned off, regardless of their diagnosis or not, getting turned off to physical activity or sports, because they're being asked to do things that they can't yet do, and that's not a good recipe for success. I was deciding there whether to say recipe or prescription, but I'm hungry, so I said recipe. Providing that behavior-specific praise does marvelous, marvelous things, not only for self-esteem, but making sure that they perform the exercise or the movement correctly, quicker as well. So it's everything that I do is designed not only to alleviate frustration from the athlete, but from the practitioner as well, because bringing a fitness program into the life of an individual with autism is obviously hugely beneficial. I would hope everybody on the call would think at this point, and I still do. But it's tough. It can be challenging, which is why I've created these programs and why everything has been what we would call in the trenches tested for a long time. So these are all things that are definitely as much practice as they are theory. We want to limit verbal prompting. We don't want too much language, do this, do that. No, don't do it that way. We want to eliminate all the negative So none of the no's, none of the not that way, none of the you're doing it incorrectly, because not only is it not reinforcing, but it also, it just plain doesn't work. I'll put it very easily, it just doesn't work. It's not very helpful. There are many different ways to develop a particular movement pattern. So I've these 20 different activities in the PAC profile, and you can build an entire program. You can have years of programming with those 20, but the beauty of fitness is that you can also create your own programs based on those movement patterns. So if we say, okay, we need little Peter to learn how to squat, you don't just have to take my protocol for squatting. That's what's worked successfully with my athletes, but it's by no means the only way to do it. So you can figure out some creative things to do, and even if you use those 10 or those 20 activities that I've outlined, then you can start putting them together in different combinations, and there's no real wrong way to do it as long as the individual is learning it at their ability level and is mastering each activity along the course of that. And we also have to ask, what is the primary goal? A lot of people put kids into sports programs because they want them to socialize. If socialization is the main goal, that's fine, but then where are we satisfying for general movement and play? So we always have to ask, what is the main goal? In addition to asking those two big questions, what do we say we're doing versus what are we actually doing? If we're not having fun, neither are your athletes. There's some aspect of fitness that eventually you should seek out enjoyment, because otherwise it's going to be very difficult to teach, and you're going to get burnt out even quicker than the student or child with autism or young adult for that matter, because you're not going to wait. It's going to be a chore to go out and teach it. But if you start moving a little bit and you start doing some of these activities yourself and having fun with them and learning them and getting more adept, it's going to be a lot easier to teach them. So that gets to our end point here. Start moving seriously and playfully and seriously playful, because it's all intertwined. And here, of course, I have a special deal. But before we get into that, Nancy, did you have anything you want to get into? Because that's kind of the end point of my little speech here for the last 2 hours. So if you have anything you want to bring up,
lots of people are asking how to get started with this program, and I think you're about to get into that.
Yeah. Well, we have the PAC profile. The PAC profile has all of these activities. It has all the background information in depth that I've provided, how to put together a program in the home, in the school, anywhere, how to assess, and then how to develop these programs. And actually, for this webinar, I'm also going to include 2 free ebooks. Those have a lot of picture demos of the different activities, and the 2 ebooks are my Autism Fitness ebook, which has a ton of different activities that I've described here and even more. And the second one is my bike riding ebook, which is Bike to the Future. So if they order the PAC profile on PACProfile.com within the next 48 hours. So by 11 o'clock on, what is today? Today
Wednesday.
Would be Wednesday. So if they order by Friday, they'll get those 2 free ebooks. And then we're also going to be doing an Autism Fitness membership site soon. And the cool thing about the membership site is there's going to be a lot of videos of my seminars, different exercise activities, because I'm constantly coming up with new ways to move around and new ways to break it down and then make it more challenging for individuals on the spectrum. So those are a couple things. But the PAC profile is available on PAC profile. That's PACProfile.com.
Okay. Before we run out of time, I did want to ask how people can contact you with more questions or get more information.
I pride myself on making myself pretty easy to contact. If you go to autismfitness.com, you can find all my contact information. Best way to get a hold of me for consulting or setting up an individual call or anything like that for seminars is to email me eric@autismfitness.com. So all the information is on there, or you can just email me eric@autismfitness.com.
Very nice.
All right.
One of the questions that came in was how to work with someone who has behaviors, hitting, kicking,
sure. Oh, yeah, absolutely. That we always have to look at what the primary goal is. So if it's a safety issue, then we have to deal with that first. But that's really it's a tolerance issue if we're talking strictly with a fitness program. So what I would do in that situation, and not knowing the particulars of the situation and when the kicking and the hitting starts also, is it only in demand situations when they're being asked to do something? Is it when they're transitioning? Is it when they're doing something new? That's all information that would be absolutely necessary. But if, say for example, it's just a tolerance issue and they start kicking and biting or whatever the behavior happens to be when introduced to a new activity, what we're going to do is introduce it slowly, and I like to do what I call the secret introduction, where I'll just put a medicine ball down or a spot marker or a sand ball next to them, and they become acquainted with having the object around there. The next thing is I'll hand it to them, and they just hold it for a second, or they don't hold it for a second. And the next, and it's a slow build. But the expectation gets higher and the skill level gets higher because the demand is slowly increasing. And it's funny, what I've found in my practice is when I start very, very slow and I say, all right, next week we're going to get to 3 seconds of holding, it winds up being 3 minutes. And we have these periods where it's not just going from 3 seconds to 5 seconds, but all of a sudden it goes from 5 seconds to a minute and a half, and because it just clicks for that individual because, number one, they develop the skill set, and number two, they find something about it reinforcing. So behaviors we deal with a lot, and that's the adaptive component of the PAC profile is figuring out, does this individual tolerate the activity? Are they motivated? And what can we do to make their experience as positive as possible?
I have a girlfriend who's really into stretching and wondered if you would recommend having that as part of the program.
You can. It depends what type of stretching. What I find is that from a stability perspective, there are a lot of different types of stretching.
Mm-hmm.
And it's tough when you start saying, well, what about yoga, or what about this? Or, well, what's the goal of the program? If I want to develop more stability, and I have an individual who has difficulty holding up their arms for a little while, flexibility isn't necessarily my main concern. And a lot of the activities that I have in the PAC profile or on the videos on the website, they will create that flexibility as well, while developing the strength and the stability and the coordination also. So the stretching, it depends what kind of stretching, it depends what type of individual, it depends what their needs are as well. So I think sometimes people want definitive answers where I can't necessarily give them. I will say in general, I think it's more important to get a lot of these activities in place and have them doing the bending and the pushing and the pulling and the rotation and the locomotion. And I think the flexibility will come from that. I've met very few individuals on the spectrum who were just very, very rigid and tight, who didn't benefit immensely just from beginning to move around a little bit.
Mm-hmm. My son complains about his legs hurting all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've taken him to the doctor. I've taken him to the chiropractor. Nobody can tell me if it's growing pains. Is it? And I wonder if it's just inactivity.
It could be. It could be. It's again one of those things that's tough. If it's a generalized pain or a localized pain, you know, the first thing that we're obligated to say is always to see a medical practitioner. But it could be as simple or as complex as he needs to move a little bit more. And if he's not, when we don't move efficiently, that's where pain starts to occur. Nobody really has a bad back. What happens is people have poor hip mobility. They're not able to squat, so when they bend down, they start to round their back. So the back is doing the lower back is doing the job that the hips and the legs are supposed to do. Not a good idea, because the lower back is not supposed to do that. That's when people get back pain. So it's not all these people who grow into adulthood with bad backs. It's all these people who are inactive or are moving in the wrong ways, and that sets off the back. So if we create a situation, or we teach the legs and the lower body and the trunk to move efficiently and to be stronger and to have more stability, we're not going to have back pain anymore. It's that simple.
He was a big toe walker when he was a baby, and there's a couple of people that have asked, my son is a toe walker, are there any activities that might get them walking on their heels?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that's where I bring it all back to squatting a lot. But when we're able to root our feet into the ground, that's going to take a lot of pressure. What happens with toe walking is all the muscles in the front of the legs become very tight, and all the muscles in the back of the legs, including the glutes and even into the back, become kind of weak and inactive. So if we can start doing activities that stimulate the muscles of the back of the body, you can start balancing out those imbalances and those deficits. And so with toe walkers, I start getting them squatting. I start getting them moving on their heels and really being able to root into the ground. And that may be where some of the pain is coming from also, where the front of the legs are so tight and they're doing twice the work. It's all about efficiency. If you're doing twice the work, then there's also twice the stress being placed on those muscles. But if it's balanced, if the work is balanced out, then you're going to have a lot more, number one, efficiency in the movement, and you're also going to be able to generate a lot more strength as well. So you get a lot of benefit from doing things correctly.
Makes sense. Can you, one more time, just tell people how they can find you on the Internet?
Sure. Absolutely. They can go to autismfitness.com, and then I have my blog that I update fairly regularly with new videos and new articles, and that's ericchesson.com. You can tell it's late in the evening when I forget my own name. that's why I have my blog named after me. It's Eric Chesson, ChessEn.com. And then, of course, they can find the PAC profile on autismfitness.com, or they can go direct to PAC profile. That's PACProfile.com.
Wonderful. Well, this 2 hours went really quickly. I want to thank you for being here and for sharing all this great information with us.
I feel
ready to get started now.
Good. Well, it's 11 o'clock at night here on the East Coast, so go right ahead.
Well, maybe I'll wait till tomorrow.
Okay, that's fine, but at least you can plan out your programming.
Yeah.
Tonight.
Absolutely. Also want to let our listeners know that if you want a transcript of this event, you can join our Spectrum Gold Club by clicking the button on the screen or going to the website. And we will send you a copy of this webinar audio and transcript, plus send you 29 other webinars when you join. And please tell us what you think. Call us at 877-211-0212, extension 1, and leave a short comment or a testimonial. Again, that number is 877-211-0212. Thank you, everybody. Have a great night.